From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, consider all the injustice, death and destruction gone down in Palestine over the past 50, 75, 100 years. No one is more responsible for the Palestinian people's misery than the British.
The Brits, you know, they're the authors of what happened. There's no attempt to issue an apology. There's no real apology that they've issued for the Palestinians. The displacement, the compensation of people losing not just lives and loved ones, but properties as well that were confiscated.
Then, a looming famine and genocide in Gaza. Will the UK, US, Canada, and other Western powers act? Or will they render Israel aid and support?
Does Andrew Mitchell, the UK Development Minister, does David Cameron, the UK Foreign Secretary, does Antony Blinken, do the Trudeau administration, do they really want to find themselves being judged by history to have been complicit in genocide and starvation? Because to be clear, it isn't imminent. It is going on right now.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Sometime in the next 6 months, the International Court of Justice in The Hague will issue an advisory opinion on the legal consequences of Israel's 57-year occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. The UN top court will be responding to a request from the UN General Assembly, asking it to determine whether Israel's occupation is actually legal, and if not, what Israel's obligations are under international law, and what the obligations of third states are to set things right. If Israel's occupation is deemed unlawful, its settlement enterprise certainly is, all UN member states would be obliged not to acknowledge the legal validity of Israel's prolonged occupation, nor render it aid and assistance. Arguably, no country bears greater responsibility for all this mess than Britain, which asked the ICJ not to render an advisory opinion, or if it did, not to go into all the history. A rich request. As mandatory power in Palestine under the League of Nations Covenant and Mandate System following World War I, Britain was obliged to prepare Palestine's people for independence. In a census carried out at the start of the mandate, Britain determined that 78% of Palestine's people were Arab Muslims, 10% were Christian, 11% were Jewish. Having carried out its census, rather than building independence for the majority of Palestine's people, Britain turned around and handed Palestine over to European colonists of Jewish persuasion. The rest is history. I spoke about all this and the ICJ advisory opinion hearings with Victor Catton. Catton is assistant professor in public international law at the University of Nottingham School of Law and the author of the 2009 work From Coexistence to Conquest, International Law and the Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, 1891 to 1949. I reached Victor Catton in Nottingham just before ICJ hearings wrapped up. It's interesting that in the course of the advisory opinion hearings that are going to conclude in about an hour, most countries are telling the International Court of Justice to render a solid advisory opinion with a broad context, broadly framed, going back to the Balfour Declaration in its analysis. But there's about, a certain number of countries that are saying that the ICJ should not render an advisory opinion at all. It should use its discretion not to render an advisory opinion. And that, because it would only complicate matters, right? It would only complicate the peace process. And if it did, it should really issue a narrow, narrowly framed opinion focusing on helping the Security Council to reach a peace agreement, but not within the wider historical frame, going back to, many people in the course of the hearings have gone back to Balfour, the 1920 to start of the mandate, Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations. They're saying, don't consider that, it's just too complicated. So in the context of international law and the origins of the Arab-Israeli conflict, to what degree would you say all this history plays a role in the current conflict?
Well, I think it's pivotal to understanding how the conflict began. It didn't begin on the 7th of October or 20 or 30 years ago. It goes back to decisions that were made during the colonial period in European capitals, anti-Semitism, migration, huge migration of people from fleeing persecution, rise of nationalism in the Arab world, the end of the caliphate, and also decisions that were made by British colonial officials, made in the heat of the moment, perhaps not or thinking of the longer term consequences, then regretting these decisions, but not being in a position to, not being honest enough to say that, that they should change or reverse course. So, you know, you've got the Balfour policy, you had the Aliens Act prior to that, you had different plans. You had an uprising from the Palestinians opposing British policy to support the establishment of a Jewish national home almost immediately following the declaration in 1917, and these reports were suppressed. But nonetheless, there were concerns raised in the House of Lords, House of Commons, League of Nations in the 1920s. There were safeguard clauses, as you know, protecting the rights of Jews in other countries, protecting the rights of non-Jews in Palestine. There was a right of self-government enshrined in the Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations. How do you reconcile that? Promising the Jewish people a national home, but then also recognizing that the indigenous population also had a right of self-government.
Do you think, Victor Catton, do you think that Britain violated its fiduciary duty to the Palestinian people under the mandate?
Yes, I do. And I think that the way they administered the mandate and the way they left, which I don't cover sufficiently in sufficient detail in my book, by the way, but which I've subsequently done a lot of unpublished work and advisory work, the way in which the Brits left the mandate in a state of chaos and violence after causing the mess, thwarting the United Nations plan to establish two states in a kind of confederal structure with an economic union. I think a lot of people forget that the 1947 partition plan was a plan of open borders. It wasn't, did not envisage barbed wire and walls and military fortifications. So I think the way that they administered it was wrong, unlawful, and I argued that in the book. But also the way they left the mandate with no proper plan for what would happen after they left.
I mean, I was thinking about this, how to describe Britain's role in the current situation today, like, 100 years later, 80 years later. And I was kind of thinking of describing Britain as the principal intellectual author of the Palestinian people's dispossession.
No, absolutely. I mean, you can see it from the even prior to the Balfour policy, but you can see that decisions they made up to 1939 and also subsequently. So in 1939, they abandoned the policy ostensibly, but they still didn't support or didn't take enough steps to assist the Palestinians with creating a state. And since then, and especially in the last, I would say, 10, 15 years, consecutive governments have done very little to assist the Palestinians. They've not taken a hostile position, opposing their attempts to join the International Criminal Court when I was a legal advisor at the time, which I recall clearly, opposing the current reference to the International Court of Justice for what is essentially a non-binding advisory opinion, although it has important legal consequences. And also they haven't, not really reconciling or not really understanding their role. You know, there's no attempt to issue an apology. No, there's no real apology that they've issued for the Palestinians. The displacement, the compensation of people losing not just lives and loved ones, but properties as well that were either confiscated. But the Brits, they're the authors of what happened.
The British at ICJ hearings last week were amongst those who argued alongside the United States, although I would say even their argument was more fully throated than the United States' argument even. Britain argued that the ICJ should not render an advisory opinion, and if it does, it should render the most narrowly framed opinion as possible and not go back into all this history, which seems to me to be incredibly disingenuous.
Well, the Brits no longer have a judge at the ICJ, so I'm not sure that their views will carry as much weight as they once did. They don't have anyone in the court anymore.
But the judges are supposed to be independent. I mean, the Americans have judges, all the P5, the five permanent powers of the Security Council, they all have their judges who operate independently. So it's not at all clear that a British judge would rule along the lines of British foreign policy.
Well, yeah. But I think when it comes to essential matters, they tend to also articulate their views. I mean, don't forget these judges are nominated by their governments and then they are elected by governments. Of course, they sit in an independent capacity. But despite that, judges are sensitive individuals. They grow up in a culture, they grow up in their country, they grow up in a system that they're familiar with. The fact that there isn't a British judge there, I think, does matter because they can't really articulate. And there's no judge ad hoc, right? The fact that we have judge ad hocs also shows that it's a bit ridiculous because you're saying that, you know, if you have a dispute between two states and there isn't the nationality of the judge of one of the states that's appearing before the court, they can appoint a judge. And they normally appoint judges of their, not always, but they normally appoint judges from their own countries, which kind of shows you the logic is that, yeah, they sit independently, but at the same time, they recognize that they're more familiar with their own interests. And this is a diplomatic political structure at the end of the day. And we can't rule out, you know, the role of power and politics and personalities. And the UK is not what it was once. The UK is not a great power, despite being on the Security Council, that it was 100 years ago. Yeah, Brexit has weakened it. And the fact that they don't have a judge on this very important body, it is not good for them.
So if you were arguing before the International Court of Justice, if you had had the chance to get up to the little podium this past week or today to talk to the ICJ, what role would you tell them 100 years of history plays in the creation of the situation today and the importance of analyzing the situation legally, strictly from a legal perspective, in the context of 100 years of history, not just in the context of post-1967?
Yeah, I mean, if I was asked to appear before the ICJ, I'm not sure I would go back 100 years because the question was specifically framed in light of the occupation that began in 1967. So, I mean, personally, my personal interest at the moment, the book project I'm working on at the moment is on the apartheid as a crime against humanity. So I was very pleased to see, I think there were over 20 or 22 states that made submissions in some depth describing Israel's policies and practices in the occupied territory, and even in some cases in Israel itself, as breaching the prohibition of apartheid in international law. And we should remember that apartheid is also defined as a crime against humanity. And it was interesting to see also this coming through in the written statements and also in the written comments, and to see some very distinguished lawyers, such as Philippa Webb and Michael Wood, make this argument was quite intriguing. It's becoming more mainstream, I guess is what I'm saying. The apartheid argument, if it began on the fringes of the left, you know, in the 60s and 70s, it was made by human rights. Well, it was then raised in some reports about 15 years ago. Then human rights groups raised it about in their reports, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem, about 2-3 years ago. And now to see the claim being made before the principal judicial organ of the United Nations is quite something, quite a feat, I would say, for the Palestinians.
But in the context of international law, like what should the ICJ consider and not consider in the context of the relevant legal framework? Fiji, little Fiji, which seems to be a staunch ally of Israel. The representative almost sounded like he was an Israeli, arguing that the Balfour Declaration was and still is legally binding. The 1922 mandate with Balfour incorporated into it was an internationally legally binding instrument at the time, and it still is.
Well, it's very intriguing if they make that claim that the mandate's still in force, and that's not good news for the UK because it could mean any state that was a signatory to the Covenant and the League of Nations could sue the UK.
Well, I think the argument is that Balfour incorporated into the mandate established this idea that Palestine, historic Palestine, would be closely settled by the Jewish people. And it's been argued, were they or were they not thinking of a state? And this has been discussed, I think you did in your book. But clearly, as it moved forward, the idea was clear that what they were moving towards was a Jewish state within historic Palestine, where, you know, 90% of the population was non-Jewish.
Yeah, I mean, but we already have a state of Israel. We don't have a state of Palestine, and so I think that's one of the issues that's subliminally before the ICJ. I mean, but I think it's a bit disingenuous to rely on a colonial document from 1917 to claim it has legal validity today in a world that's outlawed colonialism. International law doesn't support that kind of policy anymore. So you couldn't cite the Balfour Declaration to support Jewish establishment of Jewish settlements in the West Bank or the Gaza Strip if they were to reestablish them there. So I'm not sure how far that argument takes you, plus takes Fiji. Plus, of course, the Balfour Declaration itself has these clauses safeguarding the rights of the indigenous population, and it was subject to the overriding principle in Article 22 of the Covenant, the so-called sacred trust of civilization. So I'm not sure it helps. And in any event, the way in which the Brits and the UN attempted to resolve that dispute was by establishing two states. The State of Israel was established in 1948. The State of Palestine as an independent political entity does not yet exist. And I think that's the issue that people are finally addressing again as I speak.
What do you see the significance of these advisory opinion hearings lying? What's their significance? And what do you see as the greatest impact of an advisory opinion, broadly worded, decisive, incisive advisory opinion?
Well, if it is, like you said, broad and decisive and has a large majority, and if they were to accept some of the arguments that have been made. I mean, one is the occupation, but for me, that's a bit of a fig leaf because I never fought the occupation. I mean, the UN General Assembly request itself defines the occupation as unlawful, so I'm not sure what more the ICJ can add by saying the same thing. But for me, the new novel argument that they've made, as I already mentioned, is this focus on apartheid, because the claim has not been made before the ICJ since the dispute over apartheid in southern Africa, in principally in what is now called Namibia. And there are consequences. There are at least two consequences. One is, I think I counted this morning so far 16 states that are parties to the 1973 International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid made claims that Israel's practicing apartheid. That means that they have taken the view that apartheid applies beyond southern Africa.
They claimed this during the ICJ hearings.
Yes, yeah. Because they are parties to this treaty, they are now, if they want to, they could reestablish the Group of Three. This was this anti-apartheid committee that was suspended in 1995. Not abolished, suspended, because in 1995, as you know, there were democratic elections in South Africa. But that could be reconstituted, and the purpose of that committee, the role of that committee, was coordinating actions, divestment, sanctions, trade embargoes, at that time against South Africa. But there's no reason why it could not apply if there's a political will for it to apply to Israel. 109 states are parties to this treaty. It's never been denounced. The machinery is there. So they could do that even before the advisory opinion is issued, because they've already come out and said it. The significance of an advisory opinion, an authoritative advisory opinion by the principal judicial organ of the United Nations, if they were to accept the argument and to take the view that Israel's policies and practices are discriminatory and therefore breach the prohibition on apartheid, that could trigger obligations under the Arms Trade Treaty, which prohibits states' parties from transferring certain types of weapons to states where genocide, crimes against humanity, and grave breaches of international humanitarian law are taking place. This is because apartheid is defined in international law as a crime against humanity. Some activists have tried to do is they've brought judicial review proceedings in third courts. I think there was a successful challenge in the Netherlands with regard to the sale of F-35 spare parts. There was a similar case brought in the UK courts that failed, but the claim in the UK courts was based on the Genocide Convention, the case that South Africa brought against Israel. Now, genocide is very hard to prove. You've got to prove specific intent to destroy a group in whole or in part. Apartheid is a much easier crime to prove in the sense that it's obvious. You look at a state's constitution, Israel, we have the nation state law. You look at their administrative laws, They look at their practices. And if you can show, as many of these NGOs have done, that apartheid is being breached, and if you have an authoritative statement in the form of an advisory opinion, that could then be brought before domestic courts, even though it's not binding. Well, even the case is not binding. It's only binding between Israel and South Africa. But holding that view, it could provide an avenue for activists or affected individuals, individuals directly affected by the violence, to bring judicial review proceedings in UK courts or in other states such as Germany, which is also a signatory to the Arms Trade Treaty. So it could have consequences in that regard. In the short term, I suspect what will happen, depending on what the court says, that the opinion will be rendered to the body that requested it, which is the United Nations General Assembly. It will take note of the opinion, and then it's really up to Palestinians to draft, you know, language with a view to trying to enforce third states' obligations, to enforce international law. But at the end of the day, the General Assembly can only issue recommendations. So it's really, again, it's a question of political will. The Security Council, as you know, will not enforce it, even if it's referred to it, due to the US veto. Possibly even the UK would veto a resolution on enforcing international law. So that's kind of where we are at, the kind of like that level. But I mean, who knows? The Brits have already said, if Israel, the British Foreign Office, I believe, has said that if Israel does launch an attack on Rafah, they may, regardless of what the ICJ says, they may restrict the export of weapons to Israel. So that was already being discussed at the moment.
The US, the UK, Canada, and a bunch of EU countries like Germany, they really don't want international law to be applied to the current conflict.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, is that a question or a statement?
No, it's a statement. They talk about, Israel must abide by, we support Israel's right to defend itself in Gaza, with the caveat that it must abide by the norms of international law. But they just give lip service to the norms of international law. They don't enforce the law. And they were really, really moved heaven and earth to stop the General Assembly from asking the ICJ to render an advisory opinion. They don't want the law to get in the way of Israel's right to do as it pleases.
Yeah, I agree with your assessment.
Thank you so much, Victor.
Thank you. Thanks, David. It's a pleasure.
Victor Catton is Assistant Professor in Public International Law at the University of Nottingham School of Law in the UK and author of the 2009 work From Coexistence to Conquest, International Law and the Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. I'll link to Victor's other writings at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, please subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about Earth systems, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Assault on Gaza is now into day 156. Ostensibly aimed at wiping out Hamas, Israeli leaders openly admit they aim to wipe out Gaza, slim its population down by 90% or so, driving Gazans into Egypt or wherever, the sea if need be. 5.5 months in, Gazans are starving and sick, all according to plan. Israeli War Minister Yoav Gallant announced at the get-go that all food, water, electricity, and medicine would be cut off from the sliver of a ghetto already under comprehensive siege since 2007. As Israel turns the screws on Gaza, its leaders take aim at an old enemy, the single most important organization on the ground in Gaza, providing Gazans with food, schooling, and other social supports, the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA. At the end of January, Israel alleged that 12 out of UNRWA's 13,000 staff members in Gaza had joined in with Hamas in its October 7th assault, a hoary Israeli tactic that invariably works for a while. Western powers quickly suspended aid to UNRWA. As it turns out, various media outlets and governments have concluded that Israel's accusations against UNRWA are thin gruel, essentially baseless. Sweden and Canada have renewed funding. Now, as it happens, Israel's hate-on for UNRWA goes back decades, indeed, four decades before Hamas came to be, back to UNRWA's founding in 1949, brainchild of Swedish diplomat Count Folke Bernadotte. Bernadotte was the UN's first mediator in Palestine, appointed to the role days after Israel's founding on May 20, 1948. On September 16, 1948, Bernadotte submitted his first plan, central to the Swedish diplomat's vision, providing for the Palestinian people's right of return to lands they'd been expelled from inside Israel, and, in the interim, creating an agency to help refugees out. That organization would emerge as UNRWA. Bernadotte did not live to see it. One day after submitting his plan, on September 17, 1948, Count Folke Bernadotte was assassinated by Zionist militias led by future Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. I spoke about Count Folke Bernadotte and UNRWA with former UNRWA spokesperson Chris Gunness. I reached Chris Gunness in London. Chris, I'd like to talk about the current situation that UNRWA is facing in Gaza and elsewhere, in the other places where it operates, and of course the current humanitarian situation in Gaza and the looming famine, accentuated, exacerbated by the difficulties that UNRWA is facing. But I'd like to go back to 1949, when UNRWA was formed. If you could tell me how it was that UNRWA came about. It was officially formed on December 8th, 1949. How did that come about, and what was the role of this Swedish diplomat, Count Folke Bernadotte, who died before UNRWA was formed? But tell me about all that. Tell me about UNRWA's founding and Bernadotte's role in it.
UNRWA was voted into existence by the General Assembly in 1949 and became operational on the ground in May 1950. And this was a response to the 1948 war, which saw 750,000 refugees either forced from their homes or who fled their homes. Those in the north went into Lebanon, those into the northeast went into Syria, some went into Gaza, some went into Jordan, some went to the West Bank. And as UNRWA's name, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, suggests, there was relief, so immediate humanitarian relief for the refugees, which involved obviously medical aid, food aid, shelter, the things that refugees need immediately they flee. But there was also a plan for what they call durable solutions, which was to provide them with works, with employment in the areas where they fled. Now, it soon became apparent that the fledgling state of Israel, contrary to Resolution 194, which embodies the right of return, Israel made it clear that it would not respect that resolution and allow the refugees back to their homes. So in a matter of years, UNRWA began to morph from being a relief organization into a development organization, because the refugees' children needed an education where they were, so UNRWA had to establish schools. There was a need for health, so UNRWA began about 150 primary health clinics, and also relief and works. So the refugees needed social support, they needed their social networks. And those three areas, education, health, and relief and social services, today are the main departments in UNRWA's core functions. But of course, because the Middle East is so unstable, UNRWA is constantly having to provide relief and emergency services while continuing to maintain these core services, which are part of its long-term human development strategy. So Gaza today is a very good example. Although UNRWA is running over 700 schools for over 550,000 children across the Middle East, in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, the West Bank, and Gaza, although UNRWA is running primary health clinics across the Middle East, although UNRWA is feeding over 2 million desperately poor and fragile and vulnerable refugees across the region, it has to suddenly provide services for, frankly, over 2 million people in Gaza today.
Israel had an antipathy, the state of Israel had an antipathy towards UNRWA from the very, very start. One might also almost say it had a hate on right from the very, very beginning.
It did.
And that antipathy was reflected towards Count Folk Bernadotte, who really was the one who kind of brought it about. Tell me about Count Folk Bernadotte.
So Bernadotte, I think his story illustrates five things. Here was a man who early on was a visionary, and he realized that the refugees had rights, and they had a whole panoply of rights which are embodied in the Universal Declaration. And Count Bernadotte realized very early on that unless and until the rights and all the rights of the refugees were properly respected and implemented, that the Middle East would remain an inherently unstable place, because you'd have this huge population of people whose rights had not been respected. But he also realized that Israel would be an inherently unviable state and would remain in a state of insecurity unless and until it respected the refugees' rights. So just to illustrate, you know, what I was saying earlier about Bernadotte, his story elucidating so much of what is relevant today. First of all, his story illustrates the triumph of the extremists and extremism in Israel. So, you know, it was a member of the Stern Gang with which the future Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir was associated that executed, that murdered, I should say. Execution has a legalistic connotation, and it was a murder, it was an assassination.
And I think it was actually Leahy, not the Stern Gang.
Well, they are more or less the same thing, I think it was fair to say. The Leahy, yeah, you're right. The Israeli government persisted in covering up the Stern Gang's involvement in the killing as well. They were involved. But my point is that it's extremism, and it's the extremists within Israel who set the agenda, and the murder of Bernadotte, just as today in Israel, we're seeing the extremists setting the agenda. Secondly, we're seeing the predominance of Israeli lies and disinformation, just as in the late 1940s, the Israelis lied to the General Assembly about who reported on the killing of Bernadotte. The Israelis lied about the involvement of several members of the Lehi. And indeed, it wasn't until after the statute of limitation for murder expired in 1968, so these people were beyond the arm of the law, that they actually admitted their involvement.
And it's important to note out for listeners that Count Folk Bernadotte submitted his plan, the Bernadotte plan, to the United Nations, laying the groundwork for UNRWA and the right of return on September 16th, 1948.
Exactly.
September 16th, 1948. The next day, September 17th, he was assassinated.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think this precisely illustrates the points that I'm making. The third point I wanted to make about the way that Bernadotte's life and his ideas illustrate what's happening today, the impunity. So I've mentioned the extremism predominating. I've mentioned the Israeli lies, which they told about, you know, covering up what they were doing, which is so much a feature of what's happening today, with so much disinformation about the conflict being spread by Israel. But thirdly, the impunity. And what you saw was, for example, Yehoshua Cohen, who was the man who actually murdered Bernadotte. He went on to be given a very prominent job by Ben-Gurion, the Israeli prime minister. And of course, Yitzhak Shamir went on to become the prime minister. So, you know, and what we're seeing again today is impunity. Although we are, you know, I think things have changed now. We've got the International Court of Justice accusing Israel of plausible genocide and making it quite clear that Netanyahu, the prime minister, the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, and Yitzhak Herzog, the president, are actually guilty of inciting genocide. And in the case of Yoav Gallant, who's called for a complete blockade of Gaza, he stands accused of genocide, of perpetrating starvation as the occupying power on a people that Israel, under international law, the Geneva Conventions, is obliged to protect. Fourthly, the fourth way that Bernadotte's life, I think, illustrates what's going on today is Bernadotte was very clear that the refugees had rights. And, you know, from this, one can extrapolate that although he was giving UNRWA its mandate, and that UNRWA's mandate was linked to this idea of refugee rights, Bernadotte was very clear that these are human beings, and these are human beings with rights. And in a sense, it doesn't matter whether UNRWA exists or not, and this is me talking, not Count Bernadotte, it doesn't matter whether UNRWA exists. These are people with inalienable rights, and that those rights include the right of return. And whether UNRWA exists or not, those rights must be and ultimately will have to be respected. And whether Israel and the far right in Israel rejects them or not, be very clear, you cannot airbrush out of history either a people's collective memories of their homeland, of where they came from, of their identity, but you can, neither can you airbrush out of the international discourse their status as refugees and their rights of refugees. And, you know, those ideas go back very much to the thinking of Count Bernadotte. Very, very lastly, and the last fifth point I would make about the way that Bernadotte's life illustrates all this, at a time when there is clear talk in Israel about driving 2.3 million people from Gaza into the Sinai, into Egypt, and forcing them out of historic Palestine, Bernadotte would tell you, if he was alive today and on this podcast, that it doesn't matter where the refugees are. They could be in Switzerland, they could be in Canada. The right of return is a right enshrined in the universal jurisdiction. And it doesn't matter where on the planet anybody is, that right pertains. So, you know, Israel and the far right can try and airbrush out of history these refugees' rights. It can attempt to ethnically cleanse them and force them into the Sinai. It can do all of those things. And it seems like the Security Council, the Americans and the Brits, they're giving logistical support, financial support, political support, diplomatic support. And so, you know, it's possible that these things may happen. Who knows? But the fact is that even if these things do happen, Count Bernadotte's essential point lives through the decades. And that is that wherever they are, they have the full gamut of rights as embodied in the Universal Declaration. They have group rights, they have individual rights, and those rights include the right of return.
But I mean, this is the core of the matter, the internal core of Israel's antipathy towards, hate on for UNRWA that goes back 40 years prior to the emergence of Hamas, which emerged in 1987. UNRWA emerged like 1949, and Israel wanted the refugees, those 750,000 people they'd driven out, Israel wanted them to vanish. It wanted them to go away and not even not return, but not even think about returning. And so UNRWA kind of perpetuated this idea that the Palestinians have a right to return, and even worse, kind of helped them stay where they were with that hope in mind.
Of course, that's not true, right? UNRWA does not perpetuate the refugee crisis. What perpetuates the refugee crisis is the failure of Israel and the failure of the international community to resolve the rights of the refugees in the context of a just and durable solution. UNRWA would go away and the refugees, their rights would be resolved if they were to be granted, as all people deserve and must have, the right of self-determination. So it is a myth, and it's a myth perpetrated by the Israeli far right now, that somehow UNRWA is the problem. UNRWA is the obstacle to peace. If only UNRWA would go away, then the refugee issue would be resolved. That is not true. The refugee problem is perpetuated and remains a problem because Israel and the international community have failed to resolve the refugee problem in the context of a just and durable solution. And that's why, you know, one of my more optimistic and probably completely ill-founded hopes is that one of the lessons of 7/10, of the attack on the 7th of October, is that Israel will realize that the myth, if you like, that Israel could manage the Palestinian question. That has evaporated. The myth that Israel could impose an apartheid system on the West Bank, could arrest children and torture them in the middle of the night, could do school demolitions and home demolitions, could impose a blockade on Gaza, could now commit a plausible genocide against Gaza, and still somehow be guaranteed its security. That myth has disappeared. Israelis have learnt that there is always the risk of a 7th of October attack if they think they can continue to manage the Palestinian issue. What they've surely just woken up to is the idea that they have to resolve the Palestinian question, not manage it. And on the Palestinian side, I hope that they have learned that they need to grant Israel its security. Now, there's an irony that, you know, an organization considered fringe and isolated and a terrorist organization, which, you know, part of Hamas clearly is, though Hamas is a political movement and far more. But the idea that that political movement, that terrorist organization, characterize Hamas however you will, that that needs to grant the state with the most powerful army in the Middle East, it needs to grant Israel security. And only when there is that rather asymmetric realization will the Palestinians have a state, the right to self-determination, their right to development and prosperity and justice and accountability, all those things. And conversely, only at that point will Israel be granted its security. And I would like to think that one of the things that will come out of the appalling events of what's happened since 7th of October is that there will be this realization that the two peoples are interdependent, they are neighbors, and the only way that they can actually have the Israelis' security, the Palestinians a viable state, is if they are two parties who talk to each other, and part of that conversation has to be a resolution of the refugee question. That doesn't mean that every single, you know, Palestinian refugee would necessarily come back and, you know, live in Israel. There are many different ways the right of return can be implemented, compensation, reparations, call it what you will. But I hope that one of the things that might ultimately come out of the appalling events of the last 4 months will be that realization and therefore genuine moves towards a two-state solution. And that's why, obviously, Netanyahu has to go, because he so opposes a two-state solution. And let's hope that on the Palestinian side, perhaps Marwan Barghouti will be released. Let's see if a visionary leader, a sort of Palestinian Nelson Mandela, will emerge who can lead the Palestinians towards a just and durable solution. That's a pipe dream, but I don't think it's one that we should dismiss out of hand.
But I mean, just to put a fine point on this, I'm looking at a press release from B'nai B'rith Canada, B'nai B'rith Canada, that refers to itself as a staunch defender of the State of Israel. This is something that it published in February of 2021. It says, unlike the UNHCR, UNRWA does not seek to solve the Palestinian refugee problem, but rather to perpetuate it as a political weapon against Israel by, among other things, insisting on a claim of the right of return to the Jewish state for those uniquely designated as Palestinian refugees. I mean, this is their core problem with UNRWA, isn't it?
Who's B'nai B'rith? Sorry, but who's B'nai B'rith? And what right do they have to pronounce upon issues of international law, of refugee rights? On what basis do they possibly have the right? I suspect they are a politically motivated organization that, like so many around the world, are doing the bidding of the far right in Israel. I don't know the extent to which they speak for any Jews or Israelis, let alone the Palestinians, and certainly not for international law, if those are the sorts of views they are going to be espousing, because those views are absolutely wrong in terms of the law, certainly, because, as I say, UNRWA refugees have rights, and it doesn't matter whether UNHCR is looking after them, the other refugee agency in the UN system, or UNRWA is. My point is that refugees have three choices. They can have integration where they are, they have the choice to go to a third country, or they have the right of return. And UNHCR offers refugees exactly those choices. And by the way, UNHCR's preferred remedy, as they call it, is the right of return. Why? Because in their long experience since 1951 of dealing with refugees, the right of return produces the most stable outcome. It's much more stable for erstwhile enemies to go back home and to learn to live with the people who drove them out and who turned them into refugees. So it doesn't matter, you know, whether they're UNHCR administered or UNRWA administered. The fact is that those refugees would have the right of return, and UNHCR's preferred remedy is the right of return. There is a myth that UNHCR exclusively offers refugees resettlement in a third country, and if you give the refugees to UNHCR, they'll pack them off to Canada and to goodness knows where. That is a myth. It's a deliberate misunderstanding of UNRWA's mandate and UNHCR's mandate. It's a deliberate politicization of the issue in support of far-right dreams in Israel, which frankly are ill-founded, and they're not going to happen. I mean, you know, that's what B'nai B'rith needs to get used to. It is not speaking with any authority in terms of international law. It is doing, from what I can understand, the bidding of the most far-right government in the history of Israel.
Well, let me jump in here. I mean, with another, and forgive me, here's another quote of theirs from just December 1st, 2023, this past December, and you've heard these charges before. As B'nai B'rith has warned repeatedly, there is strong evidence that the organization's schools have become conduits for violent incitement. Educational materials such as textbooks used in UNRWA schools are rife with anti-Semitic caricatures, rhetoric glorifying terrorism, and promoting the erasure of the Israeli state. I mean, this is the burning inner core of Israel's hate on, isn't it?
I mean, that's just wrong. I mean, I don't know why we're even discussing this. These are lies which are put out by groups that are doing the bidding of the most far-right government in the history of Israel. The United States Government Auditing Office, the GAO, did a root and branch audit of UNRWA. UNRWA is the most audited agency in the history of the United Nations. And in, I think it was 2019, the GAO came to UNRWA. I was there, did a root and branch audit of UNRWA, including its textbook, its neutrality frameworks, everything. And guess what? America carried on funding UNRWA to the tune of $350 million a year. Does B'nai B'rith, whoever they are, think that if there was any truth to their assertion that UNRWA was preaching the eradication of Israel, that the American government would continue funding UNRWA to the tune of $350 million? I mean, I don't know what planet these people are on. It's not the same one as I'm on, and it's not the same one that, you know, those who understand international law understand the running of UNRWA. And let me be clear, they are part, I suspect, of this echo chamber. There are groups like UN Watch, like Human Rights Monitor, like Impact SE, who are, as I say, doing the bidding today of the far-right government of Israel. Impact SE and UN Watch, they once did this massive critique of UNRWA's curriculum, and guess what? They got the wrong curriculum. They were actually not talking about the PA, the Palestinian Authority curriculum, which is taught by UNRWA in Gaza and the West Bank. They were talking about the Jordanian and the Egyptian curriculum. That's how trustworthy these groups are.
Now, we only have about 5 minutes left here, 5 or 6 minutes, Chris. I'd like to talk about the current situation in Gaza, which is, it's really surreal. We're hearing about imminent famine.
It's not imminent. It's not imminent. It is going on now.
Aid delivery, you know, not getting through, you know, aid trucks being fired on. But Israel says, of course, Israel says it does not impose limits on aid shipments. It's aid agencies and humanitarian organizations who are to blame. And yet we're seeing this constantly, the disaster that's unfolding, the famine.
That's sick. This is all sick. This is sick stuff. The idea that the occupying power that since 2007 has imposed this appallingly illegal collective punishment on Gaza, and since the 7th of October has been restricting humanitarian aid at the instructions of its defense minister. Let's be clear, this comes from Yoav Gallant, who said there should be no water, no fuel, no food. So you don't have to, you know, you don't have to look for whether it's true or not. It's at the orders of the man who is in charge of the Israeli army. The idea that this organization, which has imposed on Gaza this extraordinary restriction of aid in violation of the provisional measures ordered by the ICJ, the highest court in the world, on the 26th of January, which is very clear, there can be no restrictions on humanitarian aid. Before the 7th of October, UNRWA was taking in 500 trucks a day. That is now well under 100. And that is going on because the Israelis are restricting it. And for them to say that it's the aid organizations like UNRWA, who they've mounted a political attack against. And let's be clear, on the last day of February, we saw the pictures of the IDF shooting at people coming to collect aid in the middle of the night. The most powerful army in the Middle East shooting at people against whom they are imposing and inflicting mass starvation. They are blaming the aid organizations and the people of Gaza for that. I'm sorry, that is sick. There is no other word to describe it.
And the UN Office of Internal Oversight has just released a report, and they're going to be coming out with another one in March, I think. And they disclose that there's no evidence. Actually, they've been unable to uncover any evidence to corroborate Israel's charges.
Exactly. I mean, here you have the Israeli authorities pushed into this echo chamber I just described, which has all these groups like UN Watch and Impact SC, etc. The New York Times is very much not so much part of that echo chamber. It's the loudspeaker of that echo chamber. The New York Times splashed across its front pages these allegations, which they bought hook, line, and sinker. And that led 16 donors to UNRWA to defund the agency to the tune of half a billion dollars. And guess what? Here we are, a month on, there's been an investigation by the highest investigative office of the United Nations, independent of UNRWA, by the way, because the last OIOS report saw the former Commissioner General of UNRWA effectively forced out of the agency. He resigned, but because of an OIOS report into financial misdoings and a sexual scandal. So the OIOS, let's be clear, are independent and authoritative. They have found no evidence to corroborate the Israeli dossier, the intelligence dossier. Even the Americans have said that they have low confidence in this intelligence. And it's clear that the Brits, the Australians, that all the donors, none of the donors had proper evidence when they made the decision to defund UNRWA. And I would say that those donors, rather than, I mean, yes, there should be a spotlight put on the neutrality frameworks in UNRWA, there should be also a spotlight shone on the neutrality frameworks of the donors, because they have allowed politics to influence their humanitarian decision-making. And that is a violation of the humanitarian principles of neutrality and impartiality. So, A, those donors, on the strength of this OIOS report, they need to refund. This OIOS report, which has found no wrongdoing, has not corroborated the Israeli allegations. That is a ladder on which all of these donors who've defunded UNRWA can climb down. They must immediately refund UNRWA, because guess what? If they do not do that, they will find themselves complicit in starvation, complicit in genocide, and guilty of supporting the political agenda of the most far-right government in the history of Israel. Does Andrew Mitchell, the UK development minister, does David Cameron, the UK foreign secretary, does Antony Blinken, do the Trudeau administration, do they really want to find themselves being judged by history to being complicit in genocide and starvation? Because to be clear, you said starvation was imminent. It isn't imminent. It is going on right now. Starvation is a slow motion massacre. And that massacre, as we saw on the last day of February, that massacre has begun.
And if funding is not restored to UNRWA and UNRWA collapses, if UNRWA is no longer able to deliver services in Gaza, what will be the consequences for the Gazan population, who are already suffering hugely?
A humanitarian catastrophe will become a humanitarian apocalypse. There's no doubt in my mind at all about that. UNRWA is, with its 13,000 staff and its warehouses and its food distribution centers, that UNRWA is the only game in town that can stave off the starvation that is taking place right now. And what we're seeing is 2.3 million people as a result of direct political choices, Western governments doing the political bidding of Israel. We are seeing that starvation taking place as a result of direct political choices. This is not like the Ethiopian famine in the mid-1980s. This is not a natural disaster. This is a political choice which our governments are taking. And people of conscience all around the world need to tell their governments, tell their elected representatives that they do not want to be complicit in genocide and starvation. This madness, this slow motion massacre of the people of Gaza has to end. Already, the UN is saying that more people are likely to die of starvation than because of these 2,000 pound bombs that Israel is dropping in Gaza in violation of international law. So we need to end the immorality and this madness and the impunity and the violations of international law. You know, this is the first time in history that the world has a live-streamed genocide.
And Israel's targeting of UNRWA really is aimed at advancing its, if I may say so, genocidal objectives.
I agree. I mean, the destruction of UNRWA is part of a political grand scheme which is, you know, redolent of some of the worst excesses of the 20th century in order to eliminate a people and their rights. And of course, we all know from the history of the Second World War that that is impossible, that ultimately a people's right to self-determination will triumph. You know, I went on the anti-Semitism marches in London and chanted with the rest of the crowd, "Never again." Well, never again is a universal cry. Of course, it applies to the Jews, but it also applies to the Palestinians.
Chris Gunness, thank you for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much for having me.
Chris Gunness is former spokesperson for the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA. Read more about UNRWA, Count Folke Bernadotte, and Gaza at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out. For now.